I got tickled at Tim's comment about Mason coming without his parents, because when Daniel and Nicole wrote that they were not feeling well and not going to be here this evening, I wrote them back and said, Mason will cover my sermon. Most of you are aware that at the end of service, he comes up and preaches the second sermon. And so they may be getting a sermon at home. Maybe a better sermon than what you're going to get. It's good to see everybody here this evening. We have some visitors with us, and we're certainly grateful for your presence. In the last year, 2014, we studied a series of lessons in which I presented some marriage basics. And those marriage basics were really basic. And maybe 20 or 30 years ago, we would have said about a couple of these, they're not really necessary for us to talk about. But they are now, aren't they? That marriage is between a man and a woman, one of the first things that we talked about. And that marriage is of God. And those two things just alone would eliminate a lot of the foolishness that's going on in our country right now with respect to same-sex marriage and marriage in general. Marriage is permanent, we continued, and it is a partnership. Permanent in the sense that each individual relationship is intended to be for life. And it is a partnership, meaning that we don't control entirely the condition of that relationship. I might be a really good husband, and in fact, I am. But that doesn't determine whether Debbie's going to be a good wife. Now, most of you know that of the two of them, well, never mind, you know. But it's a partnership, and so you have to work together. It doesn't depend, success of a marriage doesn't depend entirely on one spouse. And we talked about the fact that marriage is good. Marriage has gotten a bad rap in our country. It's viewed as restrictive and slavery by some, for the woman in particular. But God intended for marriage to be good. In fact, I really believe that marriage is designed to give us a taste of the relationship, the love, and the companionship, the fellowship that should exist and will exist between us and our Creator. And then finally, we talked about the husband-wife relationship being primary. Yesterday in the or Friday, rather, in the marriage ceremony that Tim preached for Michaela and her husband, he talked about the fact that the relationship, the husband-wife relationship, is primary among our human relationships. And one of the points we made as we talked about these marriage basics is that if we would master the marriage basics, we wouldn't have to do a lot of extensive teaching on the subject of divorce and remarriage, for the very simple reason that there wouldn't be that much divorce. It would be pretty much an unknown thing if we could master the basics. Our study this evening is intended to be the first of a series of studies that will probably extend over a period of time, not just one right after another. A series of studies that will examine the teaching of Scripture on the subjects of divorce and remarriage. And we'll be looking at some of the theories that are sometimes set out by men about divorce and remarriage. This evening, we're going to look at the New King James Version. I'm going to be using the New King James Version this evening. And we're going to discuss God's marriage law as it is stated in Matthew 19. Now, there are several passages that actually relate to the subject of divorce and remarriage. There is even a parallel account to Matthew 19, as you're aware, in the Gospel of Mark. But for this evening, at least, we're going to confine our comments, our vision, as much as possible to Matthew, the 19th chapter. We will look at Romans 7 a little bit in order to define some terms in Matthew 19. But our ultimate goal, and in this whole series, is to encourage a proper respect for God's law, and certainly for the relationship of marriage. And I wanted to begin by saying that divorce is the exception. That's something that we really want to avoid, but we understand the reality of life. And sometimes men don't follow the marriage basics. I mean men, mankind in general. And so teaching on divorce is absolutely necessary. We want to talk about some of the terms that are used in these texts, and particularly in Matthew 19 this evening. And the first term is the term fornication. Now, if you're reading from the New King James Version or the ESV, you're not going to see the word fornication. That word appears in the King James Version. It's not a word that's actually used very much in our vocabulary, even in religious circles. In fact, the translation in most of the more modern versions is sexual immorality. But the word that is translated, fornication, or by the phrase sexual immorality, is a word from which, as you can see by its transliteration here, porneia, is a word from which we get our English word, pornography. And Arndt and Gingrich, in their lexicon, indicate that it can refer specifically to prostitution, but it's a general word that refers to unchastity of virtually every kind of unlawful sexual intercourse or relationships. And so this word is a rather general word. Thayer says that it is a word that talks about illicit sexual intercourse in general. You may recall when we studied in 1 Corinthians, those of you in the adult class, that in chapter 7, we noted that Paul wrote that in order to avoid fornication or sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife and each woman have her own husband. And so accepted sexual relations are within the marital relationship, and essentially everything outside of that becomes illicit or sexual immorality. Now, another term that is very important that we understand is the term adultery. And as you followed along, perhaps with Eric in his reading in Matthew 19, you noted that it appears in that passage. Thayer and Arndt and Gingrich both give adultery as the definition for the Greek word. Well, that doesn't really help us a great deal. And in fact, it really kind of hurts us a little bit, because if you then go to the English dictionary, Webster, and define adultery, what you're going to find is that there'll be some sort of definition that'll sound like this: that adultery is sexual intercourse between a married person and someone other than his or her spouse. Webster says that adultery is sexual relations outside of the marital relationship. And that definition is flawed, as the word adultery is used in the New Testament. And so we need to spend a little bit of time talking about the biblical definition of adultery. In Matthew 19:9, and again, I want to emphasize, I'm using the New King James Version this evening. In fact, I had not intended to say this, but I will go ahead and say this. The ESV does not include the second part of this verse in Matthew 19:9. However, if you use the ESV, you can go over to Matthew the 5th chapter, verse 32 in the Sermon on the Mount, and in that passage, the same phrase, essentially, is included in Matthew 5:32. And so the teaching in Matthew 5:32 is the same as Matthew 19:9 in the second half of the verse. That's why I'm feeling comfortable using the New King James Version, although normally I would use the ESV. But here's Matthew 19:9, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Now here's the problem with Webster's definition. In the second half of Matthew 19:9, we've got somebody who's committing adultery with his spouse. It's not sexual relations outside of the marital relationship, as Webster defines the term. It is, in fact, sexual relations within this marital relationship that is an unauthorized, or I should say adulterous, marriage, as defined by Matthew 19:9. Whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. He commits adultery with his own spouse. And so, according to this passage, it's really possible to commit adultery with your marriage partner. And so Webster's definition is not biblically correct. And we understand, of course, that Webster's defining the words in the English language as they're typically used in our common vernacular, and not necessarily the way the Scriptures would talk about those terms. And so what we need to do is we need to go to Romans, the 7th chapter, and take a look at an illustration that Paul uses there. Understand, in Romans 7, Paul's intention is not necessarily really to instruct us about marriage. In fact, he's actually talking about the relationship of a person with the law of Moses, and he uses the marital relationship to illustrate that principle. We're kind of going the other way, and that's all right, but I wanted to note that because Paul does not include the exception that you find except for sexual immorality in Matthew 19:9. That's not his point. His point is to talk about the obligation or the matter of being bound within the marital relationship. And so let's read, beginning in Romans 7, verse 2, "For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then, if while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she's free from that law, so that she's no adulteress, though she has married another man." Well, what do we learn about adultery from this passage? Well, first of all, this passage teaches the same thing that Matthew 19:9b did, and that is that adultery can be committed with one spouse. Verse 3, "So then if while her husband lives, she marries another man, what is she? She's an adulteress." So she's got a husband, she's now married to another man, and she's an adulteress even though she's married this second individual. The text literally is she's joined to another man. Secondly, this passage, I think, illustrates the fact that in defining adultery, we need to look more at the question of being bound than being married. We already saw from Matthew the 19th chapter, verse 9 and verse 3a in this passage, that adultery is not necessarily determined by whether you are married to someone or not. The more important issue is whether you're bound to somebody or not. And in fact, in this passage, you've got a woman who's divorced from one man, and yet because he still lives, she's still bound to him, she marries another one. She's committing adultery in that second marriage. Why? Because she's bound to the first man. Adultery is sexual relations with someone to whom you are not bound. You might be married to that person, but you're not bound to that person. And Romans 7 is critical because it makes that distinction between being married and being bound. I want to spend just a few moments here talking about some conclusions from Romans 7, verses 2 and 3. First of all, a person obviously can be married and bound to his or her spouse. Debbie and I are both married and bound. Neither of us were married prior to this relationship, at least as far as I know. And so when we were married, we were also then bound to one another by the Lord. Secondly, it is possible for a person to be bound but not married. So this woman who was married to a husband, if she leaves him, divorces him, she may not marry anybody else, but she's still bound with respect to him. The law still requires her to be, faithful, but divorce doesn't break the bond between the two of them. She's not free, as verse 3 says in the latter part of the verse, she's not free to remarry or marry someone else. Third, a person can be married but not bound to his or her spouse. And we've made that point, I think, already. When she divorces one husband, marries another, she's bound with respect to the first husband. She's married with respect to the second husband. But she's not bound to him. You can only be bound to one person at a time. A person can be released from the law of his or her spouse and be free to remarry via the death of the spouse. That's the principle that he's getting at in marriage, in order to illustrate the relationship of a man in marriage, a man in the law of Moses, I should say. For a woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband, how long? As long as he lives. And so until he dies, she's still bound to him. She may divorce him, she may marry somebody else, but she's still bound with respect to that first husband. Paul's point with respect to the law of Moses is that those Jews were bound to the law of Moses. Well, the death had to take place in order for them to be released so that they could be married to another, and that is Christ. Romans 7 is critical because it helps us understand exactly what adultery is. Not the Webster definition of it, but the fact that adultery is sexual relations with someone other than a person to whom you are bound. You may even be married to that person. But Romans 7 teaches that there's a critical difference between being married and being bound in some cases. Now, having said all that, I think a lot of incorrect views of marriage and divorce stem from a failure to observe the distinction between being married and bound. People have a tendency to think that if you are married to someone, then everything's okay in that relationship. Because after all, God approves of marriage. We need to understand from Romans 7 that there's a distinction between those two things. They're not necessarily synonymous, being married and being bound. Let's go back to Matthew, the 19th chapter, and just kind of take a bird's eye view of what's going on in the context here. I'm going to divide this text into three sections. In the verses 3 through 6, the Pharisees approach Jesus and they ask him a question about divorce. Jesus, of course, answers that question through verse 6. Beginning in verse 7, there's a second exchange. Maybe we could describe it this way. The Pharisees follow up with another question prompted by Jesus' first answer, and Jesus again responds, concluding with verse 9, which is where we'll spend a lot of our attention or our time this evening. But then there's really kind of a epilogue, and that is the response of the disciples later to this whole conversation in verses 10 through 12. So we'll look at the context, or the text, I should say, in those three sections. Let's begin by looking at the question that the Pharisees asked Jesus. They came to him, and note that Matthew indicates that they were testing Jesus. They weren't coming for the purpose of obtaining information or understanding better what they needed to do. They were trying to put Jesus on the spot. They asked him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? In American society, divorce is very common, and any group, religious group or individual who teaches that divorce is rather limited, not acceptable to God on just any basis, is going to be criticized, is probably going to be marginalized. And in Jewish society, in Jesus' day, it was much the same way. The Jews were interested in easy divorce, much like Americans are today. And so this question is a setup question. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? There were Jewish rabbis who were on both sides of that question. This question really has as its background, its historic background, or I should say historical background, Deuteronomy the 24th chapter, verses 1 through 4. I think that's the passage that they are actually referring to, or that it forms the context for their question. There was a rabbi named Hillel, who was roughly contemporaneous with Jesus, who had a lot of followers, and he taught, with respect to Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, that a husband could divorce his wife for practically any unseemly thing he found in her. Now, there was another rabbi who was even more liberal, much more generous with divorce even than Hillel. But this view of Hillel was the view that most Jewish people apparently favored in the time of Jesus. In Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, Moses wrote, when a man takes a wife and marries her, again, this is New King James Version, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. When she's departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as his wife, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled. That's an abomination before the Lord. You shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. Now the phrase or the term that was really the matter of controversy or the issue of controversy in these rabbinical teachings was this idea of some uncleanness. Hillel said that was basically anything that displeased the husband. If she got to looking a little wrinkly, then he could put her away. That was a matter of uncleanness. There was another rabbi, Shammai, who took the position that it referred specifically to some sort of sexual unchastity. And so there was different views of that, and the Jews typically favored Hillel's view, the more liberal view. Jesus, of course, had already taught against divorce for just any cause. Matthew 5 and verse 32 records that, basically teaching the same thing that he's teaching here in Matthew 19. It seems to me that the Pharisees probably were just attempting to pit Jesus against the commonly held view of Deuteronomy 24. I think Jesus understood that, and I believe that's the reason for his question in Mark's parallel account, "What did Moses command you?" But we're going to stay here with Matthew's account, and I want to look at Jesus' response. He answered and said to them, "Have you not read?" Now that's interesting. He didn't quote Hillel, he didn't quote Shammai, he didn't quote Akiba, or any other rabbi. Rather, he said, "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female?" And said, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then, they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate." Two interesting points about that response. First of all, Jesus did not answer their question. Not directly. Instead, what he does is he goes back to the original marriage arrangement, citing in verse 5, Genesis 2 and verse 24, and talks about the intent of marriage to be a permanent relationship, a lifetime commitment. And then secondly, in verse 6, Jesus is not quoting from Genesis anymore. In fact, he is stating a principle that divorce is sinful even if there is no remarriage. He's talking about just the matter of putting a spouse away. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. That's a conclusion from Genesis 2:24. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. I think I've told this before when I first started preaching. Of course, you know, that's the deal. You've got to know everything. The preacher is supposed to know all the answers to all the questions. And someone asked me the question, "Well, what if you don't remarry? What if you just divorce?" That's okay, isn't it? Because the remarriage is what constitutes adultery when you enter into the sexual relationship of that second marriage. And I'm like, I got to figure out the answer to that. And then it hit me. Jesus said it right here. He said, don't divorce. Isn't that what he's saying in verse 6 here? Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. That's a command. And so Jesus pronounces the truth on that matter right away. The Pharisees, and that was the point I just made, the Pharisees then sharpened their question a little bit. They said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" Now that's a little bit of an unfair statement. It is not a fair characterization of what Deuteronomy 24 was all about. I don't know if you remember, when we read Deuteronomy 24... it's not really a command to give a certificate of divorce. It is a statement of, if a man divorces his wife, and if this condition is true, and if this condition is true, and so on, then he can't take her back eventually once he's divorced her. That's the whole point of Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. The Pharisees are giving the perception that what Moses was doing was he was approving of, even commanding, this business of divorce. Jesus said, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives." It was regulated in Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. But from the beginning, it was not so. Isn't that interesting? That's the second time he's talked about the beginning. He goes back to what God intended originally. He keeps drawing them away from the exception, which is divorce, back to the rule, which is a lifetime commitment in marriage. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. The thrust of the question of the Pharisees, the second question, is, aren't you contradicting Moses? You're saying that man shouldn't separate. Moses commanded to give a writing of or certificate of divorce. Jesus, of course, corrects that misunderstanding, or at least that mischaracterization. And he stated his law then in Matthew 19 and verse 9. One of the things that we'll probably return to in our series of studies at a later date, but that I do want to at least take a moment to talk about right now, and that is that when Jesus says in Matthew 19, 9, and I save you, whoever divorces, etc., he is not explaining the old law. That is a common viewpoint, that what Jesus says here in Matthew 19 can be dismissed because we're not under the law of Moses anymore. And so if he's just explaining the old law, then you can take his comments in verse 9 there and basically say, well, they don't apply to us. But what did the old law say about adultery? Well, the penalty for adultery was not divorce. Adulterers were to be stoned. So when Jesus says, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, why would that be a problem in the case of sexual immorality? Adulterers were to be stoned. Secondly, a divorced woman was permitted to remarry another man in Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. And yet here Jesus says, whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. That's not the statement in Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. Jesus is not explaining the old law. In fact, he's teaching something different than what the old law, the law of Moses, taught. And I think that's important for us to understand. Well, let's move to the third section of this text, and that's the disciples' response, beginning in verse 10. They said, his disciples said to him, if such is the case of the man with his wife, it's better not to marry. The disciples hear the strictness of what Jesus says. Jesus said, listen, there's just one reason, one acceptable reason for divorce. And when the disciples hear that, their response is, well, then it's better not to marry. Well, Jesus responds to that. He says, all cannot accept this saying. I think the saying here is the disciples' saying. You know, it's better not to marry. Well, some can do that. He says, all cannot accept this saying, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born thus from their mother's womb. There are eunuchs who are made eunuchs by men. And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. They have chosen voluntarily to abstain from any kind of sexual relationship within marriage. He who is able to accept it, let him accept it. So Jesus basically says to the disciples, well, that's fine if you can do that, but not everybody can. And so the disciples seem to be talking about celibacy, and Jesus' statement is, there are some examples of individuals to whom it is given who can follow that principle, others perhaps cannot. The disciples' view is somewhat of a pessimistic one. The goodness of marriage, in their view, depends upon easy divorce. If divorce is difficult, if it's restricted, well, then it's better just not to get married. That's a pessimistic view of marriage, is it not? Their comment, I think, also revealed that they understood Jesus to be limiting divorce and remarriage, unlike so many teachers today. Well, we need to talk a little bit more about Matthew 19, 9, and specifically the details of what Jesus says here. In Matthew 19, 9, New King James Version again, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. Matthew 19, 9 is probably one of the most comprehensive statements of God's law on divorce and remarriage. And I believe that the verse deals either implicitly or explicitly with four different individuals in four different scenarios. Let's see if we can put them together here. Obviously, without looking at the exception clause, if we just look at the rest of the first half of the verse, we're dealing with a divorce for some other cause, any other cause. And Jesus says the consequence is that a man who divorces his wife for any other cause, remember, other than sexual immorality, marries another, he commits adultery. So the first case is divorce for any cause. And we're looking specifically at the one who divorces his wife. But now, when you introduce that exception, except for sexual immorality, you have now introduced another situation with two other individuals involved. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. The exception clause makes this opposite. If he commits adultery when he divorces for just any cause, then the exception clause implies that he does not commit adultery if he divorces for that cause. So now we've got a second case. It's the case of the man who divorces his wife for sexual immorality. And he doesn't commit adultery. That's the implication of the exception clause for sexual immorality. But we're not done yet, because there's another case, or two cases, involved or introduced in the second half of the verse. Jesus continues, "And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery." Well, when he says "her who is divorced," who's he talking about? Do you see that that could imply two different individuals here? Because in the first half of the verse, he introduced two different scenarios. The scenario where an individual puts away his wife for a cause other than fornication or sexual immorality, and the case, circumstance, where he divorces his wife for sexual immorality. So now you've got two different cases. You've got a woman over here who's been divorced. She's been divorced because, whatever, she got wrinkly or she burned the biscuits. But you've got another woman over here. She could be divorced because she was unfaithful to her husband. But you know what? Both of those women are divorced women. Both of them are comprehended in the second half of this verse. Whoever marries her who is divorced. In the strict language of the text, both of those women are divorced women. So it doesn't really make any difference for what cause she was divorced. Whoever marries her commits adultery. And by implication, so does he when he marries her and they engage in sexual relations. So the second half of the verse deals with the woman divorced, regardless of which cause that is. And there's two possibilities here, as introduced by the exception clause, except for sexual immorality. Now, do I need to repeat all that? That gets a little complicated. But if you can follow that, that's just about as complicated as it gets. It's really not any more complicated than that. If you can follow those four different individuals, the two different scenarios, you basically got a comprehensive view of Jesus' teaching on divorce and remarriage. Now, there are all kinds of theories about other things, but that's a good summary of the basic law of the Lord regarding divorce and remarriage. Now, my intention this evening was to spend a few moments talking about the exception clause and its application to the second half of the verse. I'm not going to do that. We'll save that for another time. I just want you to be aware that there are some people who believe that the exception clause should be applied to the second half of the verse. And I'll just say at this point, it's not grammatically feasible. It doesn't make good common sense. The text doesn't do it. We'll talk more about that on some other occasion. Well, this evening what I'd like to do is go ahead and conclude and just say this, that the only divine approved cause for divorce is sexual immorality. Can a man put away his wife for just any cause? What Jesus teaches is, if you put away your wife except for sexual immorality and you marry another, you commit adultery. So the only cause that's acceptable to the Lord is sexual immorality. And the innocent party, the one whose mate has been unfaithful, can put the other mate away, can divorce that mate. The one who's guilty of sexual immorality may not remarry without committing adultery. That's the implication of the second half of Matthew 19:9. In a divorce for a cause other than sexual immorality, both individuals commit adultery when they remarry. Now, one of the views that we're going to take a look at, and perhaps the very next one, is the concept of mental divorce. There's a theory that suggests that in every divorce, one of the two parties is going to be able to remarry without committing adultery. And we'll talk about that on another occasion. But for the time being, I'm going to affirm that both individuals in a divorce for a cause other than sexual immorality commit adultery when they remarry. Secondly, in the absence of fornication or sexual immorality, divorce is sinful, even if there's not any remarriage. Now, I want to emphasize that point because sometimes people are in a relationship and they're unhappy in that relationship and they know they don't have a cause, a scriptural cause for divorce. There's not been any sexual unfaithfulness in the relationship. And so what they do is they reason that they'll go ahead and end the relationship, they'll get a divorce, but they're determined they're not going to remarry. First of all, that's unwise, because what happens so often is within a short period of time, usually, they find themselves lonely, they want companionship, and pretty soon they're off trying to figure out how they can remarry, when in the past they were convinced that they couldn't. Secondly, the text in Matthew 19:6 says that the divorce is sinful, not just the remarriage, the adultery that occurs in that remarriage, but the divorce itself. Two other things that we can conclude this evening. And the first one is that marriage is intended by God to last until the death of one of the spouses. When Jesus is asked this question, again, it is absolutely critical that he doesn't just jump to the conclusion, oh, well, let me tell you under what conditions you can get a divorce. He goes back to the initial marriage arrangement and indicates that it was in the beginning intended for two people to be together for life. And I'll tell you what, young people, you need to enter the relationship with that commitment. I really enjoyed what I heard on Friday night, and that is, you don't even talk about divorce. That's not an option. You don't play with that as a possibility if there's a problem. Your commitment is, if I married this person, I'm going to stay with this person. We are going to work to make this relationship function and be successful. You have to make that commitment. Otherwise, there will be problems, there will be difficulties, and it's just too easy to suddenly decide, well, you know what, I'm done with this. I just can't handle it anymore, or whatever the reason is. Marriage is intended by God to last until the death of one of the spouses. And that's what most brides and grooms vow at the time of the wedding ceremony. But sometimes it gets forgotten in the day-to-day difficulties of the marital relationship. We're going to talk more about this in some special pleading arguments that we'll look at later on. But strong emotions or feelings do not change the marriage law. I know of some relationships that, at least from what I understood of the relationship, there were two people who were just pretty miserable. But they didn't have a right to get divorced. Nobody had committed sexual immorality. And as much as I felt bad for the fact that they weren't happy, they weren't enjoying this relationship, which is really a shame, the fact of the matter is that doesn't change it, the marriage law. It doesn't change the principles that we've laid out here. Some may object to God's marriage law. They might claim that it is too difficult, it's too hard, too exclusive. If that's the truth, then there'll be some people who won't be able to remarry. And so just like the plan of salvation, there are some folks who would really like to change God's marriage law because, as I said, it's just too exclusive. It's inhumane. And you're denying people happiness if you say that they can't remarry and find happiness in some second relationship. Well, people say the same thing about the plan of salvation. It's too exclusive. You mean to tell me that everybody who's not baptized for the remission of their sins is not forgiven of their sins? That's exactly what I'm trying to tell you. Because that's what the Scriptures teach. That's the purpose of baptism, water baptism. And that's what we need to teach. Well, someone says, that's very exclusive. You're requiring obedience. You're requiring people to do something. Well, that's what the Scriptures teach. I can't change that, as much as I might like to extend the borders of the kingdom by offering free grace without anything on man's part. Well, what about the people who'll be lost? Some are going to be lost. And the fact of the matter is, Jesus said that's exactly right. Are there few that are going to be saved, he was asked. And Jesus' response was, most people are going to travel that broad road that leads to destruction. And as much as we would like for everyone to join us in this journey to heaven, the fact of the matter is, we can't change the plan. Not about marriage, not about salvation, not about the forgiveness of sins. And so this evening, what we need to do in marriage and in every other aspect of our life, and particularly if you're not a Christian, in this matter of responding to the gospel,